Hello, Monica, and welcome to the Russian Empire History Podcast. And as usual, would you like to begin by just introducing yourself to the listeners?
Well, thanks for having me. Yes, I'm Monica White, and I'm an associate professor of Russian and Slavonic Studies at the University of Nottingham.
So today we're going to be talking about relations between Byzantium and Rus, and maybe a bit more from the Byzantine side than we do normally in the podcast. And so for some background to begin with, maybe you could just kind of outline for us, you know, Byzantium had ups and downs over the centuries, and what kind of situation was Byzantium in the kind of 9th to 11th centuries when it had its main encounters with the Rus?
It was a good time, in short. So Byzantium was nearly knocked out of existence by the Arabs in the late 7th and 8th centuries. And then it got back on its feet. The Arabs really overextended themselves and had a number of succession crises that caused them to weaken. And that allowed Byzantium to get back on its feet. And the iconoclast emperors, who were very good military leaders, helped with that as well. And so the situation stabilized by the late 9th century. And then the first offensives against the Arabs were around the same time, maybe early 10th century. And so then things started to accelerate. And the 10th century was a time of a lot of military triumphs and big expansion of the borders and reconquest. They saw it as reconquest of Roman lands in the Eastern Mediterranean, you know, all the way into Syria. And there was talk of pushing further into Jerusalem. Never quite got there, but they were really on a roll pushing back the Arabs. So it's the more uplifting time to study Byzantine history because things were going well.
And so if they were doing well militarily, then they must have had a very strong economy at the same time.
Yeah, the economic history is not something I'm as much expert on, but it did recover through trade. I mean, a lot of that trade was with the Arabs because they weren't just fighting each other. There was a lot of diplomacy, a lot of trade, and they were also trading with other parts of, you know, growing Western European states at that time. And they recovered. So yeah, the Arab invasions had caused really dire economic crises. The last war with Persia in the 7th century famously caused, for at the time, Heraclius to melt down church plate to try to pay the army. So they were out of that tunnel. And there was more money sloshing around for monumental architecture. So the first Macedonian emperor, Basil I, built the first major new church in Constantinople in the 860s, I believe, called the New Church. And after that, you begin to see more monumental building, which is a great indicator for a healthy economy.
Right. And so that's right around the time that we have the first Russian expedition down to Constantinople.
Right. Yeah. So I didn't mention the Rus just then because I mean, it's unclear how much they actually contributed to the Byzantine economy. You know, we have these famous treaties and trade was definitely going on. But given the distances, it's not really clear how much they really brought to the economy. And part of that is because what they were trading didn't leave too much trace because it was fur and slaves. Both organic. So they didn't, you know, there's not a lot of in the archaeological record. But the Rus were definitely attracted to Constantinople for trade purposes. So one of the earliest references to the Rus from the 840s is an Arabic source that talks about how they go down through Khazaria and trade in Constantinople before going on to Baghdad. And that's a very matter-of-fact account, so it must have been happening a lot. And so trade was definitely the main, if not one of the main reasons that the Rus first, on both sides, there was attraction on both sides, because both sides had things that the other side wanted. So it was a great trading relationship, but the volume is not always so clear.
I'm quite interested in how these things are presented, because today we think a lot, about how, we got the colonialism and imperialism as big things. And when you're reading anything about the various steppe peoples that have been coming out and fighting with the Romans for the previous, 1,000 years at this point, they pretty much always say that they attacked the Romans or the Persians or the Chinese, whichever part of the steppe they were in order to get better trade deals. And then when the Rus go down to Constantinople and attack it, it's presented quite differently usually, as they put together a expedition that they were going to go down and conquer some new land or something, or even it was a serious military expedition. They weren't trying to just win some tributes or trade relations, although it seems that the result is they receive a treaty with Constantinople and start trading. Did the Byzantines see the Rus as like another unpredictable mobile force from somewhere out in the unknown world that had arrived that they should buy off with trade or whatever else? Or how did they look at them?
Yeah, and that's something I've been trying to get my head around, actually. And my conclusion is that the Byzantines didn't really have a playbook for the Rus, because the Rus were not actually looking to conquer, I think. I don't really think there's any evidence for that, but they were the Byzantines had a set of policies for dealing with northern barbarians at this time. It's pretty well documented. And they had, there's some great sources on foreign policy in the 10th century. But they were not used to dealing with people from that far away. And they didn't really know how to manage that relationship. Because for one thing, they were constantly distracted by Bulgaria and the Arabs, who were on either side of the empire and constantly causing trouble. And all the military handbooks and treaties just go back and forth between the Bulgarians and the Arabs, which makes sense. That was the immediate concern. So they were aware of the Pechenegs and the Hungarians, and there's some discussion about that. But the Rus were actually from the next lot further north. And the Byzantines didn't know anything about them, didn't really have the capacity to deal with them. And then they were also, they rocked up in 860 and launched a huge raid on Constantinople. Just at the time when the empire thought it was becoming more safe. That was the first recorded Rus raid, was in 860. And Byzantium had known about Rus before that, so there's evidence, Arabic sources and a Latin source that talk about the Rus in Byzantium before 860. Trading, so they probably had good relations if they were allowing them to trade. But the raiding, I think, just didn't make any sense in the Byzantines' worldview. It kind of came from out of the blue. They were not able to conquer anything, but the Byzantines didn't really know what they were capable of at first. And so in the way I interpret what happened is that the Byzantines didn't know what to do, and so they just used the playbook of offering trade treaties. They had no other choice. They couldn't go to war with Rus because they couldn't send an army north of the Danube. I mean, it's unthinkable.
Yeah.
And they had their hands completely full with the Bulgarians and the Arabs. So I call it charm defensive. But the only thing they could do was to try to be nice and offer trade and hope that that might mitigate. And that was also when the first mission apparently happened. So I think they thought through a combination of, we'll just throw everything at them, you know, trade agreements, missionaries, whatever, and just hope they go away or at least stop raiding and just continue to fight the Bulgarians and the Arabs.
Yeah, because I've always found it difficult to think that really that they were a real threat. I mean, they could have caused chaos all around the Black Sea for a long time, of course, but I don't see how they would have had the capacity to besiege Constantinople.
Well, they laid siege to it, and I think at first the Byzantines probably didn't know what. There was no way to know what they were capable of. But at least after the first raid, it must have become clear they came from so far away that they couldn't possibly, I mean, if they had even breached the Theodosian walls, which nobody had, right? How could they possibly hold the city given how far away they were from their base? So I think in 860, they had a real scare. But then it became clear that we know who these people are and they're from the dark side of the moon. And so they can cause a lot of damage, but they're not going to stick around. And we might be able to entice them into doing other things. I don't really see any evidence that the Rus were setting out to conquer anything either, because except in 972, but at the very early stages, I don't see any evidence for it.
No, I don't either. That's why I always find it a bit surprising when people seem to take it face value. But So you already mentioned a couple of times about Byzantine foreign policy, and they'd contact with the Pechenegs and the Magyars and these other people that were in the southwestern steppe at the time. And this crops up quite often that they pay the Rus to attack the Khazars, they pay the Pechenegs to attack the Bulgarians, or they always seem to be buying people off to cause trouble among them.
Yeah.
Did they have a particular policy of how they wanted to maintain their northern neighbors, or did they just try and keep everybody weak and divided?
I think it was a several-pronged approach. So there was definitely a charm defensive of, bringing them to Constantinople, wowing them with all the stuff that we have, and making them think that we're so amazing and sophisticated, which they were. I think that whole process of paying one tribe to attack another, it was less work than sending your own army, but it was still a lot of work. And so I don't think it's something they did just for the sake of it. I think there was a lot of it was about trying to attack Bulgaria from behind to get Bulgaria off of them, off of Constantinople. So, because Bulgaria was a huge threat in the century and before and after. So a lot of the steppe
Maybe you could just describe how Bulgaria at this time, because it hasn't really come up in the podcast.
People
might not be aware of it.
Right. So Bulgaria had been part of the Roman Empire. So the Byzantines saw it as their land. You know, it had been part of Rome before, you know, in ancient Roman times and then in Christian Roman times as well. And in the 7th century, when Byzantium was distracted by a huge war with Persia, there was an invasion of Slavs, closely followed by a Turkic tribe called the Bulgars, who were from the Middle Volga. So you get the Volga Bulgars. And they settled the Northern Balkans. Well, the Slavs went all the way down into the Peloponnese. So the whole Balkan Peninsula was just Slavs and a few Bulgars. And that gradually coalesced into a khanate called Bulgaria. That the Bulgars, the Turkic-speaking Bulgars, were the ruling class. And they ruled over the Slavs, who were Slavonic-speaking. And they were pagan and kind of harassed Byzantium quite a lot. And they were occupying former Roman territory. And then there was just lots of back and forth. As Byzantium kind of got to grips with the Arabs, then they turned their attention back to the Bulgarians. And so it went back and forth. And in the 10th century, in the 9th century, the Bulgarian Khan finally converted to Christianity in 864, I think. And that's when the Bulgars and the Slavs were really fusing together into a much more Slavonic kind of culture and society. And the Bulgar elite were kind of being integrated into the Slavonic majority. But the conversion to Christianity did not end the problems. And they were very wary of the Byzantines trying to take over, and the Byzantines did, in theory, want to take over. So there was this a lot of tension. And various emperors of Bulgaria fought devastating wars against Byzantium throughout the 10th century. They were always distracted by that. And so a lot of the steppe diplomacy was actually about taking the heat off themselves by making other people attack Bulgaria from the north.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, since we've brought up the conversion there, and so the Bulgarians were converted by a mission from Byzantium before the Rus, which actually I talked about in a special episode, so it hasn't been in the main part of the podcast. So maybe we just talk a little bit about Cyril Methodius and the invention of Slavonic alphabets to help bring Christianity to the Slavic peoples.
Okay, yeah. the potted version. So both sides of Christianity were expanding pretty rapidly at this time. So the Latin Christianity based in Rome and the Greek based in Constantinople. And there was a lot of rivalry over Central and Eastern Europe because they were vast pagan hinterlands that both sides wanted to convert. Although both sides were in communion with each other at this point, it was before the schism, the permanent schism of the churches. So there was a kingdom called Moravia in what's now kind of the Czech Republic area, where they had received missionaries from the East Frankish Empire who did everything in Latin. And the king of Moravia was not happy with this and had heard about another brand of Christianity where they allowed translations into the local language. So he appealed to the Byzantine emperor to send missionaries who could, I mean, he was already a Christian, but he wanted new missionaries who could do things in his local language. So this was the Byzantine Emperor Michael III, and this was in about 860, found two brothers from Thessaloniki. This was the area that had been inundated by Slavs, so there were a lot of Slavs, and it was a bilingual area, and the dialect spoken up there was not, at that time, so different from what was spoken in Moravia. I mean, now you couldn't go from North Macedonia to Moravia to be understood, but at the time, sort of. So they invented an alphabet called Glagolitic, and translated the basic texts and went off to Moravia. The mission was kind of a failure, actually, because the Frankish clergy didn't like them at all, not surprisingly. They had to go to Rome to plead their case. The Pope upheld them, but Cyril died. And so Methodius went back as Archbishop of Moravia and kept it going. But then after he died, the Frankish clergy just threw out all his followers and kicked them out, and they went back to Western Christianity and Latin.
Okay.
But some of those followers found refuge in Bulgaria, which had recently converted and was delighted to have Slavonic texts for Christian worship, because they were very worried about Byzantium encroaching. So to have stuff in Slavonic was great. The ruler at the time, Boris, took in the refugees from Moravia and set them up and gave them protection. And probably around that time, they came up with a new alphabet, which they named after Cyril, called Cyrillic. So the original alphabet was Glagolitic, which didn't look like anything you would recognize. But Cyrillic was based much more on Greek, so it was easier. And most people seem to prefer it. The Glagolitic lingered on in some isolated places, but mostly Cyrillic. And the only alphabet that ever got to Rus was Cyrillic.
So was this rivalry between the Western Church and the Eastern Church at the time purely like a geopolitical matter, or were there actually differences in their doctrines that they were arguing about?
There were emerging differences of doctrine. I mean, I think it's important not to exaggerate it too much, because the fact is that the two sides, the Roman Constantinople, had broken up and gotten back together many times before this. So there was a schism over iconoclasm. There were schisms over the Patriarch Photius doing certain things that the West didn't like. And they had always patched things up within a few years. So it was normal to have this pattern of breaking up and getting back together. But it was normal that both sides kind of knew that there were differences. So there were linguistic differences. There were some ritual differences, like you get the emergence of unleavened communion wafers in the West and leavened in the East, clerical celibacy in the West and priestly marriage in the East, things like the filioque clause in the creed emerging in the West. So they were aware of these differences, and no single one was a deal breaker, but if there was some external crisis like iconoclasm, which was the thing that went on in Byzantium in the 8th and early 9th century, that could cause a split. And then people would say, and they also do these other things. And then they would patch up the split, and then things would kind of get back to normal, and then another crisis would happen. Yeah.
I think a lot of listeners will probably be aware of the various struggles in the West between the Pope and kings over their relative places in society. What was the position of the Orthodox Church in Byzantium or Bulgaria? Did they also claim to have power over the king or the emperor, or were they?
Well, there's a lot of theory versus practice here. So in theory, the Roman emperor, as the Byzantine emperor thought of himself, was the emperor of all Roman lands that had ever been Roman, and had the patriarch, and in practice, he knew that he was not in power in a lot of those places, but it was always on the to-do list kind of thing. And the patriarch was not the top ranking, you know, the patriarch of Rome, the Pope had precedence over the patriarch of Constantinople, and there were three other patriarchs. Antioch and Alexandria, in theory, had precedent over Constantinople, which was an up-and-coming new city, relatively. It's just they were under Arab rule, so they couldn't do very much. In practice, the Patriarch of Constantinople appointed a lot of suffragan bishops who went to newly converted places. But the amount of direct influence that he or the emperor could wield through them was limited. It did happen sometimes. It's not clear that they always wanted to wield a lot of influence through bishops, because bishops had to function in their host societies as well. There was a lot more local autonomy in the East than in the West.
Right. So you didn't have, you know, envoys from the patriarch coming in and saying, like, the king has to do this or we're going to excommunicate him.
I think you could find examples of that, but not that much.
But, right. Okay. So, right. Maybe we talk a bit more then about how the Orthodox faith came to Russia. So we have already in Byzantium, they already had the Slavonic texts, and presumably they had priests who could speak a Slavonic language that was close enough to communicate with the Rus, and they made some previous attempts but were not successful. Although obviously there were some Christians of the Rus, because we see them appearing in the treaty text that they start swearing in churches instead of on their swords or whatever else.
Right, and apparently the Patriarch Photius sent a mission to Rus in 867 because he wrote a letter about it. And it's not impossible that that mission kept going on a local level and we just don't hear about it because there aren't any sources from Rus. I think it's really important not to think of conversion as a watershed set piece event. Yeah, that it was a process, it'd almost be more surprising if it didn't happen, given Byzantium was a very attractive civilization that people were eager to trade with, and people were spending a lot of time there, and then going back home and maybe bringing some ideas with them. And they were also, you know, the Rus, like the Eastern Vikings, were also traveling in Western Europe, which was more Christianized. And so Christianity making inroads into Rus is, you know, probably happened at a very early date. We just don't have any written evidence for it. The Treaty of 907 and 911 talk about that. So there's plenty of... And I see no reason to doubt that the Patriarch Photius sent a mission, and it might well have had some success. So we could have had Christianity from the mid-9th century, as early as Bulgaria, really. It might not have gotten very far. But I don't know how far it really got in Bulgaria either. It's just, you know, the royal family happened to convert at that time. How much other people converted is very open to interpretation.
Right. Was there any exchange between the Rus and Bulgaria? Or was it all from Byzantium?
There was definitely exchange at a later time. So when there was a big wave of conversion in the late 10th century under Vladimir, and at that time they really made a big effort. So they would have needed a lot of Slavonic-speaking priests, and they probably got some from Bulgaria, and they definitely got texts from Bulgaria, and used those translations that were already in existence, because why wouldn't you?
I've seen sometimes, maybe less these days, but sometimes, Russia's alleged backwardsness at various points in history or something is put down to them converting to Orthodoxy rather than to Western Christianity. And I listened to one person whose name's escaped me now, who wrote a book on this fairly recently, who said that the reason why was because the Byzantines delivered Christianity to the Rus as like a complete and finished product, whereas in the West there were centuries of debate and argument, and so when Russia, when Rus received its kind of a legacy from the classical world, they left out the liberal side of it, of debate and philosophizing, and said, well, this is all the knowledge you need, and so it stunted Russia's development in education or science, philosophy for some time. Do you think that there's any validity to that kind of view? And what was intellectual life like in Byzantium around this time?
Oh, intellectual life in Byzantium was very vigorous at this time. So they had come through a heresy called iconoclasm, which was about the veneration of icons or not. And in order to resolve that, they had to dig up a lot of obscure texts and kind of sharpen their arguments. And so that had given a bit of an impetus to intellectual life. And then the rebound after being on life support against the Arabs, meant that there was more resources for manuscripts and copying and architecture and, theology that had been a bit of a luxury before. And you get higher education coming back in Constantinople. A lot of theological debate, philosophical debate, a lot being written, a lot being systematized. A big movement in the 10th century to kind of make encyclopedic works, sort of reference works of lots of knowledge. And so that involved a lot of research into older stuff. And as far as Rus goes, I guess what I find interesting about that is the assumption that Rus is supposed to look a certain way, and that way is like Western Europe.
Right.
Part of the post-colonial project is trying to free ourselves from this assumption that the rest of the world has to look like Western Europe. And I find it interesting that for some reason, Rus and later Russia is, all of our critical faculties seem to go out the window. And if the best we can do is say, Rus didn't have the same debates as Western Europe, I'm afraid that's pretty poor. Of course, and it's a different place. It's a very trite and tired argument to talk, sort of bemoan the lack of classical literature that was taken to Rus. And it's true. As far as we know, not very much classical literature, Greek or Latin, made its way to Rus. What interests me is why people think that matters so much. Is that the only way to have a civilization? I mean, we're a bunch of Eastern Vikings who were, you know, exploring and doing lots of building and trading. Like, did they need classical literature? I don't think so. I mean, they got on fine without it. And I find it just really boring to always go back to this question. Instead, let's talk about what they did have and what they did do and why. That's what I would say.
Yeah, I always find it quite weak as well. I think people everywhere manage to argue without any problems. And so I think it's difficult to say, well, these people never learned to debate. Well, like, everybody knows how to debate. It's, 2-year-olds start off doing it.
Exactly. And you don't need to have read badly translated Plato to learn how to debate things that are relevant to you. You know, as for like the backwardness, supposed backwardness of Muscovy and the Russian Empire, I mean, that's a bit out of my time period. But the idea of certainly lots of problems in Muscovy and the Russian Empire, just like everywhere in the early modern world, but kind of tracing it back to the failure to translate certain texts or to learn Latin and Greek, I just find it really unconvincing.
And how much variety was there in the Eastern Church, like in Bulgaria, in Rus, in Armenia, or all these other countries? Was there a lot of difference between the churches, or were they all fairly similar?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I think there was a lot more difference among Eastern churches than Western ones because they were all working with their own local languages. That was always a part of Orthodox policy. I don't know at what point it became a formalized thing, but, you know, they always worked in local languages, whereas in the West, they insisted on Latin for everyone. So that actually led to much more variety, and because of the tradition of having more local patriarchs, I mean, you didn't get patriarchs in all the Slavonic countries until much, much later, but, you know, Armenia has it's not an Orthodox country, but it has its own leader, and so does Georgia. So that actually allowed quite a bit more difference to happen.
So the church in Rus would have become quite distinct from the Byzantine church fairly quickly at the beginning, or something that took quite a bit of time.
Depends how you want to define distinct. I mean, they were using a different language. You know, they very quickly acquired their own saints, although that's something that happened in the West too. I mean, you know, you get local saints that were relevant to local people in addition to the universal ones. You know, there were new feast days to commemorate local events. There was probably, you know, differences of dress and some ritual that appeared pretty quickly. I mean, again, they were quite far away from Byzantium, but they did maintain contact. There was always traffic back and forth, and not just high-ranking, but pilgrims and monks, you know, not really high-ranking monks, but people would go back and forth. So there was a certain amount of communication. And then it did drift enough so that there ended up being a giant schism in the 17th century over the you know, change that had apparently occurred from the translated texts that they got from Greek, that they no longer really reflected Greek. And anyway, that's another story. So yeah, there was a lot of drift.
Yeah, yeah, right. Because I was thinking in, just we had about Olga of Kiev just last episode. Sean Griffin in a book about the Byzantine liturgy and the Russian Primary Chronicle, and it's usually assumed that it was, you know, Greek-speaking monks from Byzantium that wrote at least part of it, but part of the liturgy is out of order, and it's suggested that that might be that they weren't Greek monks after all. They were already local monks or working, and so they'd shuffle things around.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And also, you have to kind of consider that they didn't have all the manuscripts that they did in Byzantium, and, you know, the process of getting a full set of manuscripts that you need for the full year of Orthodox liturgy would have taken years and years to translate and transcribe. So they were working off of maybe Greek originals that not everyone could read, but also very abridged versions of things and maybe incomplete, and then there would be a fire and you lose half of your manuscript. So the fact that if things are kind of swapped and changed around, I wouldn't be surprised at all. I mean, there were definitely literate Rus monks in the first generation of Christianity. And so they were perfectly capable of writing stuff. It's just, yeah, what they had at their disposal might have been very different.
Right. And just we'll talk more generally about Byzantine influence. So it's often kind of pitched that Russia is the country that's been influenced by Byzantium, although this the whole thing about the Third Rome and everything only comes up like centuries later. But now that there's a bit more attention given to Byzantium these days, and you see more scholars talk about that there was a lot of Byzantium influence generally in Europe, and they just wrote them out of the Western histories, basically. So do you think Russia was especially influenced by Byzantine or Rus, Ukraine, whatever the successor states, or was it just part of the general kind of thing that was in Eastern Europe, or more Europe more generally at the time was taking the same kind of things from Byzantium?
I don't know how you measure these things, but if you look purely at the distances involved, I don't see how the Balkans couldn't have been more influenced by Byzantium. It's just that it's covered over with a layer of Ottomans. And also, people don't care as much about the Balkans. I think people want to see Russia, and I mean Russia specifically, modern imperial and modern Russia, as this thing set apart and different and, you know, the arch enemy. And one very facile explanation for that is, oh, it's the Byzantine influence there. And of course it was, you know, the whole church was kind of, you know, basically taken from Byzantium. And obviously the church was quite influential in the Middle Ages, but you know, the political structure of Rus had nothing to do with Byzantium. The legal code, the civil law was not Byzantine. They had very strong links, trade links with the West, intermarriages with the West. So they were certainly not beholden 100% to Byzantium for everything. And the Balkans were probably a lot more. I don't know. Again, I don't know what metric.
If we're talking about writing out of history, then like Bulgaria is completely gone, isn't it? No one learns about Bulgaria in the English school.
No. Yeah. No. Exactly.
Yeah. So you mentioned to me that you've been researching cults of saints in the army, which sounds very interesting, but I don't know really anything about it. And so could you perhaps just introduce it to us and tell us?
Okay. the military saints, this was my PhD research, which came out as a book quite a long time ago. But because you were interested in warfare between Rus and Byzantium and the Byzantine influence on Rus, this topic has both. And this was a phenomenon of the Middle Byzantine kind of resurgence against the Arabs that it was a phenomenon that seems to have been new in the 10th century, that the emperors came up with a group of saints that were the special protectors of the army. And these saints were martyrs of the early church. So the famous St. George, Demetrius, and two saints called Theodore, and quite a few others, but those four were the main four. And three of them had been soldiers in their lifetimes, but one of them had not. And part of my research was to find out what was special about them, and I never really came up with an answer. It seems like they were just very prominent martyrs, and the fact of martyrdom was actually much more important than whether they had been really prominent soldiers during their lifetimes, because of the expectation that fighting the Arabs was like kind of giving yourself up for martyrdom. And there was a lot of strong hints, although that the Orthodox Church officially was against that, but the emperors were very happy to hint to their soldiers that this was the case. And those saints and their military cults became extremely popular in Rus, almost, you know, from the first mention we have of any saints at all, you know, there are military saints, and they were venerated in a very similar form, kind of as patrons of the army and the princely clan in particular. And the first two local saints of Rus, the sons of Vladimir, Boris, and Gleb, were thought to be martyrs. They were killed in a succession crisis, not really for their faith at all, but here to be martyrs, kind of joined the ranks of the military saints and in iconography. And so that was a really interesting melding of Byzantine Orthodox tradition, kind of an example of what we were talking about with having new aspects of Orthodoxy being tacked on in a newly converted land.
Right, and so was this like soldiers, you know, carrying medallions or icons of these saints? How was it expressed?
There are a lot of portable items showing them, but there are also a lot of like speeches and hymns that invoke them, and a lot of iconography that sort of made for the imperial court that shows them as a group, which was very significant because they had no relationship to each other. You know, they were completely independent saints before the 10th century. They're from different parts of the Roman Empire, martyred under different emperors, no relationship. And then all of a sudden, these completely random saints are always depicted together. A lot of stuff that's imperial commissions, like ivory carvings, which most people couldn't afford. And so it's pretty clear that they were very attractive to the court, and who was then promoting them in things like speeches. There are a couple of examples of speeches to soldiers on campaign about kind of how you need to prepare for martyrdom, and here are your saints.
This was, I think I read about this, was the Byzantines trying to inspire their soldiers in a similar way to the Arab armies they were fighting, their promises of paradise if they died fighting the Byzantines. And
Yeah, I think the Byzantines were aware of that, but of course the Islamic idea of martyrdom came from the Christian one originally, so
a lot of back and forth there.
But I think there was a 10th century emperor who wrote a military handbook and expressed admiration for the kind of rhetoric that they used and how they inspired their soldiers and stuff. So yeah, they were aware of it.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah. Did they carry the icons? Because I don't know when it began, but certainly, you know, in Russia later, they had these miracle working icons that they would take to battle and then say that the icon won the day for them.
Oh yeah, Absolutely. Icons, relics, and not just of military saints. So Mother of God and the True Cross were often carried into battle. Whatever you could get, really.
When did that start? Was that an early? Because I don't think there was really an equivalent to that in the West, was there?
I don't know about the West. I mean, yeah, this was something I looked into in quite a bit of detail, but I think there's evidence for it here only by the late antiquity, I think after the reign of Constantine, but certainly before the era, before, you know, the last war with the Persians, they were already using relics as defensive items. But there wasn't, and then Heraclius in the war with Persia kind of used strong religious rhetoric. I don't know if he carried icons or relics, but he definitely brought in a sense of holy war that hadn't been there before, but he didn't have the military saints as a group the way that the later emperors did.
Okay.
And did the Byzantines ever try to use being Orthodox to bring the Rus into any of their wars to defend them?
Well, I don't think Orthodoxy was the selling point at first. So they started using Rus mercenaries in the early 10th century. So the first reference to Rus mercenaries is on a campaign to reconquer Crete in 911, which is the same year as that treaty. And that treaty also mentions Rus in mercenary service.
Yeah.
And after that, you know, lots more references to Rus on campaign. I mean, well, you know, most of them were probably not Christians at that point, if any. So I don't think the Byzantines really cared about them being Christians or not. I think they were Vikings, and so that's what the Byzantines are interested in. I mean, much later, the Byzantines kept asking for money when the Turks were just about to topple them. I think they mostly just wanted money. I don't think they asked for mercenaries at that point. I'll have to check that.
Because there was a Viking crusader expedition. Yes, but then all of these crusades that were supposed to support Constantinople, or at least in some way, all seemed to come from the West rather than coming from Rus, that you might think would be a closer ally if it was supposedly so under Byzantine influence. And
yeah, I mean, I'm sure some individuals, we know like there were princes exiled to Byzantium who probably helped out here and there, but I don't think after the sort of heroic Viking age, they didn't keep coming in large numbers,
right,
as far as we know.
Well, maybe as a last question, sorry, I didn't tell you in advance, so maybe I'm putting you on the spot. You could recommend a book about Byzantium to our listeners, something that...
So there's one by Jonathan Harris, which I really enjoyed and gave to my students, which I will come up with the title for. The Lost World of Byzantium. It's very readable, and it's really good at explaining the imponderables of Byzantium to a modern audience. And I used to teach a whole history of Byzantium from beginning to end, and I gave it to final year undergraduate students who responded pretty well to it. And I think that's the best you can ask.
Right. Okay, so thank you for that. Thank you for coming on the show. It's been very interesting talking to you.
Thank you for having me.